Lisa is in crisis. She has gone through a protracted meltdown that has uprooted her from her well-established life and deposited her unceremoniously here in central Mexico with her daughter and no idea of what's going on or why. I know where she's at. I know what she's going through, but I'm not her shrink or her drinking buddy. I'm not going to play the role of drawing her out. I turn back to my laptop and continue reading. Sensing that she might have lost my interest, she tries to regain it with a more direct appeal.
I don't know what to do, she says.
About?
About my life, she says forcefully. I had a life, and now I don't, and I don't know what happened to it or how to get it back.
I wait.
I can't just hurl myself into a life of reckless spiritual abandon, you know. I have responsibilities. I have my children to think about. I had a career, standing in my community, friends, relationships. I guess that's all gone now. I still have my credit rating to think about. If I start missing payments, even by a few days, my credit score will go down and they'll raise my rates. That's serious, you know. I have to think about my future and the future of my children. You joke about living out of dumpsters, but that really happens. I mean, I'm not afraid it would come to that, but who knows what could happen?
I don't say anything. Frank mentioned that she'd read my books. Now she's trying to get me to defend her decisions while she rails against them, which is not a service I provide.
I can't just let go of everything and hope for the best, she continues. It doesn't work that way. I mean, maybe it works for you. You seem to be happy and have a nice life and everything. But who knows what the deal is with you? I mean, you're obviously an exception, to say the least. You look like a human being, but I think that's very deceptive. It is, isn't it? You're really not like the rest of us, are you? It's one thing to read about you, to read your books. But when I'm here with you, and Maggie is here, and my father, well, then it's very different.
I wait.
I think you may be a very dangerous person, Mr. McKenna. No offense.
None taken. Call me Jed.
I don't mean to be rude, but I'm sitting here looking right at you, and I don't really know what I see. You're more than just dangerous. I have to keep reminding myself of that. You're like this weird, corrupting influence that sits by the pool and offers me lemonade and lets me live in his house and says, call me Jed.
And listens patiently, I add. Take a breath. She takes a breath.
Well, yes, and listens patiently. Sorry. Thank you.
So, what's with the day planner? She looks down at it, and I can see that she's drifting out of focus a bit. So I go back to my work. She doesn't speak for several minutes.
I got a good night's sleep last night, she says, her mood more settled. I haven't had a good night's sleep in years. I forgot what it was like.
We were living in a motel room for the last month, so Maggie could finish out her school year. And I've been bouncing off the walls. No sleep. She pauses to consider.
I feel good, I think.
Sorry to go off on you like that. Minutes pass as she sits quietly, and I return to my work. George walks past on his way down to the dolphin fountain. Lisa watches him, then gets up for a glass of limonada. I used to watch the Mexicans doing the yard work, she says with an air of longing. I'd be so envious. Such a simple life. I fantasized about being a homeless person, living under a bridge, going to the library and just reading all day. Begging for coins
so I could have my raspberry banana smoothies. I guess I thought living out of dumpsters sounded okay. That's how bad it was. I dreamed of being homeless. That's how bad what was? Life. My life. Still in a bit of shock? Oh, yeah, she says, nodding. That's how it feels. Numb, like I just got out of jail. Like the last 15 years are just this blur where I was always tired and worried and busy. And now it's suddenly over, and I don't know what to do, or where to go, or who to be. I guess I'm rambling. I might be a little nervous talking to you. I hope I'm not being rude. I'm very grateful to be here with you. Very grateful. I think I might have to declare bankruptcy, too. That's really freaking me out. Believe me, I'm about the last person anyone would expect to declare bankruptcy. Between a dentist and a lawyer, you must have been doing well, I say. Two professionals, kids, house in the suburbs, living the American dream. She barks out a disturbed laugh. Some dream. We were drowning in debt. It was terrible. The American dream was like being slowly suffocated, like an elephant sitting on your chest. That was normal. But now it seems completely insane. No escape. No way out. No wonder I went nuts. Thank God I did. How else can you get out of something like that? Friends weren't any help? What friends? She scoffs. You know, I don't even know what that word means. I always thought I did, but I don't. Not really. Anyway, all the people we knew were just like us. Careers, kids, debt. Half the people I knew were self-medicating. A lot of them were medicating their kids, too. That's how the whole thing holds together instead of just flying apart. Everyone's got their pills, or booze, or both. You have to. And then massive doses of caffeine to kickstart each day. She pauses and sips her drink. I spent 3 hours and 20 minutes a day commuting. Car, train, bus, walking, and in elevators. I timed it. She's looking at me like I'm supposed to be doing the math, but I know she already has. Over 800 hours a year, she says. More than a solid month of every year, just traveling to and from work. More than 15 months I spent just commuting. All we really have is time, and that's how I spent mine. Just flushed it away, wished it away in small pieces, being eager for the time to pass, for the trip to end. Then the same thing in the office from 8 until 6, watching the clock, wishing the morning away so I could go to lunch, wishing the afternoon away so I could go home. Never happy where I was, always busy and tired and preparing for the next thing. Weekends were actually worse because that's when everything that didn't get done during the week had to be done. Cleaning, shopping, kids stuff. What are you going to do with the kids? Take them to some fast food dump with a playground. Feed them some cheap, sugary crap you know is no good for them, and head off to the mall. You try museums and ball games. But junk food and malls are the reality. Dennis plays golf and watches sports on the weekends because he has to unwind after his long work week. He didn't even commute. His practice was in town. He thought having all that free time commuting sounded nice. She takes a long, deep breath and slowly releases it. She has her back to the beautiful view. I was like that little girl in your first book, she continues. I started seeing this whole human transport system. Me and the same few hundred people I saw every day but never spoke to, just shuttling back and forth like mindless sheep, all with our newspapers, laptops, headsets. I think about it, of the whole world stuck in this same huge machine, getting endlessly, pointlessly processed. Old ones falling out and new ones replacing them. Every morning, these steel tubes all around the world, carrying millions of people, pumping them like fresh blood into graveyard cities, and pumping them back out at night, dirty and tired, like a brotherhood of sheep, of captivity, of mindlessness, of lives unlived, of empty activity. Everyone, though, not just commuters, clerks in stores, cops, bus drivers, everyone you see. You get inserted into this machine when you're 4 or 5, and you don't come out the other end until your 60s. Once you start seeing this place for the madhouse it is, you can't stop seeing it that way. It's everywhere, everyone. It doesn't make any sense. That's not life. It can't be. I don't know what it is, but it's not life. This is what Chief Broom calls the Combine in Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But it's what Kesey was calling the Cuckoo's Nest itself. Protagonist Randall P. McMurphy flips out when he discovers about his fellow inmates what Plato tells us of those shackled in his cave. Our captivity is voluntary. No one is being held against their will. There are no locks keeping anyone chained in their seats in Plato's cave, and the patients in Nurse Ratched's ward are there voluntarily and can sign themselves out whenever they want. That's what freaked McMurphy out. We are enslaved by our own fear and ignorance, and we can be free as soon as we can will it. The patients on Nurse Ratched's ward are happy there. They don't want to go out into the big, scary world. They are paralyzed by fear and soothed by constraint. In Kesey's book, Chief Broom made a break. In Lisa's life, Lisa made a break. This book, by the way, is dedicated to Ken Kesey, not just for Cuckoo's Nest, or the bus, or the pranksters, or the acid tests, but for the courageous and visionary spirit behind all of them. Ken Kesey was Randall P. McMurphy, and 60s America was his madhouse. And he takes a rightful place beside Walt Whitman and Herman Melville in the American pantheon of heroic explorers. Of McMurphy, Chief Broom narrates. He goes to getting ready for bed, pulling off his clothes. The shorts under his work pants are coal black satin, covered with big white whales with red eyes. He grins when he sees I'm looking at the shorts. From a co-ed at Oregon State, Chief, a literary major. He snaps the elastic with his thumb. She gave them to me because she said I was a symbol. And for what? Lisa continues. This wasn't for a few months or even years. This was our whole life. We were trapped. 15 years of it. Isn't that nuts? And for what? To raise kids? That's just an excuse. Anyone can raise kids. You don't have to live in constant, soul-crushing servitude to do it. One day I asked DJ what he really wanted out of life, and he said he wanted to be a dentist just like Daddy. It was like being kicked in the stomach. She shakes her head sadly. And you know, it's not just that it's a terrible way to live. It's not really life at all. It's not something you choose. It's what you get when you don't choose. We just marched ourselves into these damned, idiotic, impossible lives without ever stopping to think about what we were doing. High school, college, post-grad, and then straight into the workforce. Get married, have a kid, borrow money, buy a house, fill it with junk, have another, borrow more money, bigger house, more junk. It's completely insane. But that's how everyone I know lived. Affluenza, they call it. Like a disease. That's what it is. For the last 7 years, we've been struggling just to make the minimum payments on our debt. And this was all pretty normal? She laughs bitterly. Everyone I knew was the same way. Some at a higher income level, some lower. But I think practically everyone we knew was dangerously overextended in every direction. Money, time, work, responsibilities. We were doing everything right, and we didn't really have any misfortune, no tragedies or health issues. We've been members of the local country club for 10 years. Yes, we were living the American dream. Exhausted, broke, not good parents, not happy, and now split up. She pauses. I didn't really have a nervous breakdown, you know. I know. I had a moment of clarity. That's what it was. But I knew it wouldn't last. I knew I'd get swallowed back up into this state of marginal consciousness where years fly by like minutes. So I made a vow to myself during that moment of clarity. I swore that I would end it. Whatever it took, I promised myself that I would get out. I had to break the cycle and grab the kids and run like hell. I reminded myself about my vow every day, but I was slipping back anyway. I was forgetting the vow and why I made it. It's like anesthesia, like when they make you count backward from 100. You think you're okay at 97, and then there's no 96. And it all just came flooding back when DJ told me he wanted to be a dentist. It was like being slapped awake, and I knew it was now or never. I knew it was my last chance to make a break. My mistake was trying to figure out how to do it cleanly and take both kids with me. Way too ambitious. I packed for myself and Maggie, wrote a note, jumped in the car, and got out of there. I made a terrible shambles of everything, of course, at home and work, but I knew that was the only way it could happen, and that it was now or never. Now or never. There was no nice way. It was just too fucked up, and I'm sorry, but there it is. Jesus. It was that, or be stuck in that death trap forever. Me and my kids. I think of it as a breakdown sometimes, because that makes it sound excusable. If I was sane, then doing something that horrible could only be called evil. I don't think I'm evil. She's red-eyed, but not crying. I can see she's cried out. You are sane, and you're not evil, I say. I guess you know that. It's nice to hear it, she says, especially from you. It's just so hard to reconcile. The proportions seem so, I don't know, disproportionate. But that's how it had to be. Anyway, it's done now, for better or worse. And here I am. Here we are, Maggie and me. Rock and roll, I say. She smiles and nods solemnly. Rock and roll,
she says. Good, I say. Good spirit. That's everything.
There was no other way.
I know.
Please tell me. I haven't made the worst mistake anyone could ever make, she says. Tell me I haven't ruined my children's lives. That's all I want to hear.
How do you feel now?
She closes her eyes and sighs heavily. I can't describe what a relief it is to be out of that situation. I can breathe now. I can sleep.
She gestures to indicate this garden paradise in which we sit.
You don't know how amazing this all is. I can't believe I lived like that. I can't believe I considered that to be happiness and success. I can't believe I thought that was life.
So, was getting out the worst mistake you could ever make? I ask. Her face breaks into a huge smile.
It was the best thing I've ever done, she says jubilantly. I don't know what's coming next, but I am so glad to leave that world behind. This has been the whole death, rebirth thing you talk about. I know I'm scared and confused right now. That's okay. I'll get through it. But I'd rather die than go back to that life, or whatever the hell that was.
Chapter 7. Imago. Perhaps the deepest reason why we are afraid of death is because we do not know who we are. We believe in a personal, unique, and separate identity. But if we dare to examine it, we find that this identity depends entirely on an endless collection of things to prop it up. Our name, our biography, our partners, family, home, job, friends, credit cards. It is on their fragile and transient support that we rely for our security. So when they are all taken away, will we have any idea of who we really are? Without our familiar props, we are faced with just ourselves, a person we do not know, an unnerving stranger with whom we have been living all the time, but we never really wanted to meet. Isn't that why we have tried to fill every moment of time with noise and activity, however boring or trivial, to ensure that we are never left in silence with this stranger on our own? Sogyal Rinpoche. It's evening. Lisa has put Maggie to bed. She opens a bottle of wine and pours us each a glass. She hands me mine and sits down across from me, glass and day planner in front of her. She'll be going to bed after this, but I still have to go out and walk the dog and have my nightly nightcap with Frank and then come back here and try to get in another hour of work. Lisa sits quietly and sips her wine. She needs to be pushed, and she wants to be pushed, so I give her a push. Why are you carrying your day planner? As if it requires a burst of resolve, Lisa takes a deep drink, then opens the leather-bound book to a page near the back and places it in front of me. It's a photo from a magazine. Black and white, grainy, laminated and hole-punched, buried deep amid the calendar and contact pages. It's a body falling from the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001. You can tell by the shape of the hair and clothes that it's a woman. Her face is just barely visible, just enough to imagine features, to wonder.
I look up at Lisa and find her deeply entranced by the photo. She removes it from the day planner and holds it. She rubs it with her fingers. She speaks in a very quiet voice. "It was a Tuesday," she begins in a quavering whisper. "She got up just like a thousand times before, showered, woke the kids, got her husband going. She took time to notice that it was a beautiful September day, and to share that with her family, trying to make the daily grind a little easier, to make the day seem special, but it was just another Tuesday. By 6:30, her house was awake, and everyone's grumbling through their morning routines. Once she had everyone going, she returned to dress and do her face and hair, standing in front of the mirror in her slip, thinking about work, about the day ahead, about family schedules and upcoming events, about the lines in her face, the extra pounds on her body, bills, her parents' health, just like any other morning. Lisa's eyes are shimmering with tears now. Her fingers rest on the bottom of the photo. "When I first saw this picture, this woman, seconds from death, I couldn't take my eyes off it. It held me like a trance. And this whole backstory, this woman's life as I imagined it, her house on Staten Island, the ferry ride to work every morning, it all just flooded over me. I taped the picture to my bathroom mirror, one just like this. And every morning, as I went through my daily rituals, I'd look at it and think about how she started her day just like I am now. Just another day. Brush teeth, floss, worry about little things, thoughts full of details and concerns." She pauses, sips her wine. I don't say anything. "That first picture got ruined. Dennis didn't like it. He said it was morbid. He didn't want to have to look at it every morning. I didn't want anyone else looking at it anyway. I got this one and protected it and put it here where only I could see it. I could sit with her on the train ride in the mornings. I talked to her, I guess. And she talks to me. That's how it happened. It started out as this sense that the life I was living was all wrong. I resisted that thought, tried to push it away, but it wouldn't go away. It just stayed there at the periphery. Always there, just at the edge. Office, car, dinner parties, grocery shopping, club, meetings. Always there. Then your books." She laughs and looks at me. "Your books just threw on the house lights, exposed everything, made everything raw. And that's when it built to the bursting point. It had to do with your books. But it had been slowly building for the 3 years she'd been talking to me." "The woman in the picture talks to you?" We sit in silence for a long time. "I was a nobody. That's what she says to me. I was this way for my boss, this way for my co-workers. I was this person for my parents, this person for my children. I was this person on the phone, this person with store clerks and staff. I dressed for other people, spoke and behaved for other people, spent the minutes, hours, and days of my life for other people. And there was never anything left for me. I read books and magazines to help me be all these different people. I spent what little time I could spare shopping and at the gym to keep thin and well-dressed, always struggling to be these people I needed to be." Lisa speaks in a whisper and holds the picture in both hands. I worked 10 hours a day and commuted too. I cooked, cleaned, shopped, paid bills, and was lucky to get 4 hours sleep a night. I told myself it was all for the children, but I always knew that was a lie. We could have done much better for the kids. We were just stamping out more versions of ourselves because that's all we knew how to do. We became just like our parents because we didn't know who else to be. That's what I'm thinking as I fall. That it's hard to be sad because I don't know who's dying. What does it matter that I'm gone if I was never really here? I'm 2 seconds from the end of a life that was never really mine. I was all these people, but I was never me. And now it's a beautiful September morning, and my life is over, and I don't know who to be. I don't say anything. Lisa sniffles and smiles at me and laughs. Then she starts blubbering about how she wishes she hadn't been such a prude in school, and how she should have tried more drugs and toured for a summer with the Grateful Dead, and maybe spent a month in a nudist colony. She laughs self-consciously and puts the picture away. That's usually when I start tuning her out. She takes a break to freshen up. Despite her pain, I can only be happy for her. What's dying in her is something that should die. What most people call life is really just the fearful protraction of a pupal state, like butterflies too scared to emerge from the cocoon. The butterfly stage of development is called imago, adulthood. That's what we are meant to be, imago. If we lived in a society of imagines, we would be well prepared for metamorphosis. It would occur when it's supposed to, and be easier by magnitudes. Not easy, but not cataclysmic either. But we don't live in such a society. And when the transition happens, if it happens, it is more likely to result in catastrophic upheaval than a coming-of-age ceremony. Nevertheless, I'm happy for her. No one visiting a coma patient suggests that they look peaceful and are better off spending their life in that state just because waking up from it might be unpleasant. Lisa pours herself another glass of wine and returns to her seat. The photograph is what started the whole thing for me, she says. But who knows? It wasn't a big event. It was like a tiny pinprick, just a little jolt. But right from that instant, you know it's fatal. Like a poison has been injected into your system, and there's no antidote, no hope. I think I knew right from the very beginning what it really meant, what would have to happen. I fought against it for 3 years, tried to keep it pushed aside, tried to bury it under all the minutiae of life, work, family, home. But all that time it kept growing in me, growing like a cancer. What was it, really? A thought? A realization? A glimpse? I really don't know, but it's definitely a point of no return. I knew all my denial was just a temporary solution. I knew I was heading toward my own ruin by staring at the picture every day, but I couldn't help it. It would have felt like a betrayal not to. That was a painful time. I felt like a stranger in my own home, like an alien in human disguise. I had the secret thing growing inside of me. As it got bigger, the other me, the mom, the wife, the attorney, all the rest got smaller. I was looking out through the same eyes, but behind them, I was an imposter, a pretender, trying to hold on to a world that was no longer mine. I knew from the first chapter of your first book that the time had come, that whatever was happening to me would soon be born after this uncomfortable 3-year gestation, that this thing that had been growing inside of me would burst out and ruin everything. And now here you are, sitting in conversation with me. I smile. Ain't that a piece of luck? I guess you and I wouldn't be sitting here talking together if I were just normal, the way I was, if I wasn't in this goddamned meltdown. I mean, it's not like we're, you know, I don't know. Never mind. What would we be talking about if you weren't in this meltdown? I ask. Your retirement plan? A shoe sale at Bloomingdale's? The war on terror? I guess not. Never mind. So you're asking me, if you weren't on fire, if your life wasn't in flames, could we be having this conversation? And the answer is no. Our voices could never bridge the gap. But because you're in this crisis, and because you are here with your death by your side, we can talk. My death? She asks quietly. I laugh, but gently. Certainly, I say. Who do you think that is in the picture? Who do you think you've been talking to on the train and in the bathroom? Who do you think is trying to slap you out of your coma? We take our glasses out to the loungers by the pool and watch the play of moonlight on the lake below and the mountains beyond. The conversation settles into a more relaxed mode as she makes some effort to understand who or what she's talking to. I was just reading some New Age book in Dad's library that said there were probably several million enlightened beings alive right now. Is that what you think? She thinks. No, not enlightenment the way you talk about it, which is the only way it makes sense. I guess the book was talking about something else. Me too. I'd be very surprised if there have been 1,000 ever, or if there'd ever been more than there are now. I know there are other things out there that are called enlightened or awake, but if you stick with truth realization, it's hard to get fooled. And these other states? I don't know. Not my field. In Maya's house are many mansions. They're all just dream states within the dream state, so who cares? From what I've seen, they're usually about happiness, goodness, compassion, beauty, heart crap, that sort of thing. Does that sound like what that book was talking about? Heart crap? Sure, all the ways we have of putting a pretty bow on our fear so we can be happy in the dungeon instead of smashing out of it. You're not into happiness? I'm not into anything. You're into truth? Not really. No one's into truth. I used to be into not living a lie, but that's over now. Now I'm into writing books, but that's almost over too. Soon I'll be into something akin to sitting in a rocking chair on the front porch, me and my dog, watching the world pass by. We sit in silence for a few minutes. We moved into a hotel at first so Maggie could stay in her school and I could stay at work, but it was the same thing. I could feel it, still too close. The old life was sucking me back in. I knew if I went back, that would be it. I'd be lost. My kids would be lost. I was so scared. She looks away. And now, here you are. I say, because it seems like my turn to say something. The pool had some weird thing where it changed colors at night, but I figured out how to turn it off, and now it just stays cool blue. You have to go somewhere, she says with a bit of heat, still looking off into the night. You can't just run off and join a commune or a nunnery. So I ran back to Daddy. Is that your point? It's not, actually, I say. I'm on your side, even if you're not. I'm very tired, she says. Please don't talk in riddles. You can just run off and join a commune, or a nunnery, or something of the sort, I say. But you didn't. Most people do. They do it to avoid the crisis you're now in. They bend like circus contortionists, so they don't break like you're breaking now. They make parallel or backward leaps into new systems and ideologies where they can keep themselves distracted indefinitely. They think they're breaking out when they're only tunneling from one prison cell into another. In Maya's prison are many cells. So where could I have gone? There are plenty of solutions in place for someone who comes to that crisis. Safety nets put out by Maya to catch the jumpers. You could have called yourself a born-again Christian. People throw themselves on Christ's mercy these days if their latte is under-foaming, or to shave a few strokes off their golf game. You could have stayed in your old life and gone the Jesus route. It's pretty mainstream now. Or you could have gone to a shrink and talked and medicated your way through life. You can stay medicated from cradle to grave these days, I guess. She glowers at me. Or you could have gone to the New Age and self-help aisles of your local bookstore and bought into one therapy or a modality or ideology after another while the years flowed placidly by. You could have gone to Buddhism and run out the clock. That's what it's there for. Or you could have flown off to India or Japan on some self-absorbed spiritual quest to discover your inner whatever. There are plenty of places for people to go when they're trying to hide from the answers. But I would think a shrink or Jesus would have been your best bet. I could see myself doing any of those things. I can definitely understand the temptation. That would have been the end of it, right there, I guess. Maya hath power to assume a pleasing shape. I thought that was Satan. Is that what you thought? But I thought people were trying to find the answers, she grumbles. The answers are all in plain sight. The difficulty is in not finding them. That's what people are trying to do. That's what religion and spirituality are for, to help us not see what's perfectly obvious. To stay asleep, you mean? To stay in the dream state? Mankind is completely addicted to staying asleep, more than food, sex, or survival. Delusion. How do you break a habit like that? How? The way you're doing it. Explosively. Messily. Self-destructively. Great. In fact, what you've done, getting someplace safe and not too demanding, someplace where you can step back from your life and take an objective look and regroup, is the best possible thing. It might feel like running home to Daddy, but what you're really doing is running into the crisis, not away from it, with a kid no less. This is war, if you haven't noticed. And you haven't shirked. I know it doesn't feel like it, but you should be very proud of how you've acquitted yourself so far. I mean that on a human-wide scale, by the way. You're a good soldier.
Thank you, she says. I guess.
Heaven, salvation, compassion, mindfulness, self-awareness, inner tranquility, peace on earth, goodwill toward men. These are all safe, no muss, no fuss spiritual objectives. They're undemanding, low impact, lifestyle friendly, and easy on the pocketbook. None of these terms really means anything, so no one gets too caught up in success and failure. They don't lend themselves to fanaticism. No one blows up a bus in the name of compassion, so they don't get a bad rap. For any of them, we can feel like a valid participant. Join a group, have a practice, buy some books, get on mailing lists, hang out with like-minded people, accessorize. They don't conflict with our current conditions and can be easily integrated into our busy lives. A little meditation in the morning or evening, an hour of church on the occasional Sunday morning, sponsor a hungry kid, a little reading or discussion now and then, and our spiritual itch is adequately scratched. No one gets hurt or does anything crazy. Certainly no one unplugs themselves from the great hive and wanders off on their own. Once in a while, an overzealous kid might disappear into a Zen monastery, but they usually reemerge a few years later, none the worse for wear, and probably write a book about their experiences so the time inside won't have been a total waste. You know, Lisa continues, I've read your books. I know where you're coming from, and I'm sorry to be in such a foul mood, but...
Really?
Really what? Are you really sorry to be in a foul mood? She exhales loudly.
I don't know. No, I guess not.
Me neither. It's fine with me. Be in whatever mood you're in. You have enough to worry about without repressing your emotional state. You're in a semi-focular situation. Why pretend you're not?
Semi-focular? She laughs. I guess that's a good word for it.
Your life is ahead, not behind. You're on your own now.
I have you, she says hesitantly.
You only have yourself. But that's all you need. She slumps back into her lounge chair. She looks profoundly weary. I speak words of comfort. You're an intelligent person who's been knocked senseless by this personal apocalypse. Take some time to get your heart and mind cleared out. You have to find your bearings and your balance. This is what it is. It's the same for everyone. Breathe. Walk. Sleep. Be easy on yourself. Give yourself some time, but not too much. Use the writing to get yourself sorted out. You should be busting through crusty old layers of crap like a berserker at this stage.
That sounds relaxing, she says dryly.
Everything will be fine, better than you can imagine, but first you have work to do, hard work. It might take a while, but you'll get through it, and the person you'll become will be unspeakably grateful to the person you are right now for going through this.
No way to just skip this part?
Sure, that's what we've been talking about. The world is full of people and institutions that will answer yes to that exact question. You can try to back out of the whole thing by jumping into some other thing.
I don't know if I can really go through this for the gratitude of some future me.
Then make it about your kids. That got you this far. It sounds like you don't want to see them getting caught in the trap you just freed yourself from. Lead by example. Whatever it takes.
Do I have a choice?
I don't think so.
Me neither, she says.
She lays the empty wine bottle on its side, like a dead soldier, and gets up and walks back up to the main house. Chapter 8. Utopia. In contact with the flux of cosmic consciousness, all religions known and named today will be melted down. The human soul will be revolutionized. Religion will absolutely dominate the race. It will not depend on tradition. It will not be believed and disbelieved. It will not be a part of life, belonging to certain hours, times, occasions. It will not be in sacred books, nor in the mouths of priests. It will not dwell in churches and meetings and forms and days. Its life will not be in prayers, hymns, nor discourses. It will not depend on special revelations, on the words of gods who came down to teach, nor on any Bible or Bibles. It will have no mission to save men from their sins or to secure them entrance to heaven. It will not teach a future immortality nor future glories, for immortality and all glory will exist in the here and now. The evidence of immortality will live in every heart as sight in every eye. Doubt of God and of eternal life will be as impossible as is now doubt of existence. The evidence of each will be the same. Religion will govern every minute of every day of all life. Churches, priests, forms, creeds, prayers, all agents, all intermediaries between the individual man and God will be permanently replaced by direct, unmistakable intercourse. Sin will no longer exist, nor will salvation be desired. Men will not worry about death or a future, about the kingdom of heaven, about what may come within and after the cessation of the life of the present body. Each soul will feel and know itself to be immortal, will feel and know that the entire universe, with all its good and with all its beauty, is for it and belongs to it forever. The world peopled by men and women possessing cosmic consciousness will be as far removed from the world of today as this is from the world as it was before the advent of self-consciousness. Excerpted from Cosmic Consciousness, Richard Maurice Bach, M.D. Chapter 9. Dystopia. Do you begin to see, then, what kind of world we are creating? It is the exact opposite of the stupid hedonistic utopias that the old reformers imagined. A world of fear and treachery and torment. A world of trampling and being trampled upon. A world which will grow not less but more merciless as it refines itself. Progress in our world will be progress towards more pain. The old civilizations claimed that they were founded on love or justice. Ours is founded upon hatred. In our world, there will be no emotions except fear, rage, triumph, and self-abasement. Everything else we shall destroy. Everything. There will be no loyalty except loyalty toward the party. There will be no love except the love of Big Brother. There will be no laughter except the laugh of triumph over a defeated enemy. There will be no art, no literature, no science.
When we are omnipotent, we shall have no more need of science. There will be no distinction between beauty and ugliness. There will be no curiosity, no enjoyment of the process of life. All competing pleasures will be destroyed. But always, do not forget this, Winston, always there will be the intoxication of power, constantly increasing and constantly growing subtler. Always, at every moment, there will be the thrill of victory, the sensation of trampling on an enemy who is helpless. If you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on the human face forever. O'Brien to Winston Smith, excerpted from 1984, George Orwell. Chapter 10, Myopia. Courageous, untroubled, mocking, and violent. That is what wisdom wants us to be. Wisdom is a woman and loves only a warrior. Friedrich Nietzsche. Dr. Kim and I enter the huge writing arena building a few minutes late. We quietly take seats on a bench off to the side. 30 or 40 people are seated on a big fold-away aluminum bleacher, and a woman I assume to be Brett is standing out in the sand facing them. She's wearing jeans and a denim shirt. She's a rusty redhead, strong but not stocky, mid-40s, outdoorsy and clean-looking. At the moment, she also looks like her patience is being tested. A man of a youthful 60 is explaining that his spiritual mentor, Sri someone or other, has instructed him that it is every sentient being's duty to cherish the earth and work toward the spiritual liberation of all sentient beings. "Compassion for humanity is our reason for being," he explains. "Only in this way does our time on earth have meaning and purpose. How could I, for instance, possibly focus on my own spiritual liberation when so many are still living in darkness?" The man exudes an oily sincerity, and I wonder if I'm in the wrong place. His name, he tells us, is Stanley. He explains that he has been a long-time spiritual seeker, 40-some-odd years. He rattles off a list of names of some pretty well-known spiritual teachers and authors, American, English, and Indian, and refers to them as his beloved gurus. "Much of the world is rotting from poverty, violence, and disease," he continues. "People everywhere live in hopelessness and despair. They don't know there's a better way, that abundance, radiant well-being, and transcendent joy are their natural birthright. They don't know that they are not human beings having a spiritual experience, but spiritual beings having a human experience. My guru teaches that it is the responsibility of those who have eyes to see to come to the aid of those less fortunate, because the spiritual ascension of the human race must include everyone. We can't leave anyone behind. We are our brother's keeper. We are the custodians of this garden planet. We have an obligation as sentient beings to share a message of love and compassion with our fellow man. Until all sentient beings are able to see through spiritual eyes..." "If you use the word spiritual again," says Brett in a strong but quiet voice, "I will whip you raw." "Oh, good. I'm in the right place." Stanley is taken up short by Brett's threat, but he smiles condescendingly and continues. Okay, sure. I've heard about your tough love approach, he says with gentle disapproval. But if you ever want to be standing before more than a handful of students and have the respect of the spiritual community, you'll have to adopt a more compassionate tone and broaden your spiritual outlook to encompass not just the radical fringe, but all your fellow beings. We're all on the same side, you know. He smiles and clasps his hands together. We're all in this together. Stanley is obviously a very intelligent guy, but I've never seen intelligence as a more-is-better type deal in this regard. He next launches into what is supposed to be a question, but feels more like a lecture. It starts off being about consciousness, which almost makes me tune out because there's only one thing to know about consciousness, and talking about it pretty much means you don't know it. Then there's some stuff about an experience he had in meditation, during which, if I understand correctly, he melted into his mantra, followed by some divine revelation, and then his mantra and his heart became one and were purified in a way that was somehow attributable to the supreme guru from which, he informs us, all other gurus descend, and by whose grace he was able to see beyond form and to essence, which in turn is love, which in turn is God, which in turn is supreme guru, which in turn is self. And so he came to truly understand that the knowledge of Brahman alone is real, and the experience left his heart in a pristine, undiluted form for almost 2 weeks. I might not have all that exactly right. Stan ends it all with a question that has something to do with his search for happiness as it comes into confluence with mankind's quest for liberation. Okay, Stanley, says Brett. Go ahead and take your seat. My teacher encourages open dialogue, says Stan, not sitting. He says that the only bad idea is the one we don't express. In a world full of violence and contention, it would be a real travesty if those we turn to for spiritual guidance were unable to engage in a free flow of ideas and rise above the petty tyrannies of anger and jealousy. Yeah, says Brett. That'd be a hell of a travesty. She turns to the group. Now, for those of you who don't know, this ain't a debating society, and it sure as hell ain't a democracy. I ain't standing out here trying to win your approval or sell you on my particular brand of bullshit. We ain't doing no meditating or chanting. We ain't merging with our mantras or trying to cleanse our minds or purify our souls or get all happy or earn our eternal reward. And we sure as hell ain't trying to save the world or rescue our fellow man. All we're trying to do here, the only goddamn thing, is figure out what the hell's going on. That's it. If you don't find that to be a worthwhile use of your time, or if you think you already know, then clear out and come back when you don't need to be dragged kicking and screaming every inch of the way. She turns back to Stan. Stan, I gotta give you credit. I've heard every dipshit New Age cliche in the book, but I ain't never heard them all strung together like that before. What you need to do is give yourself a nice cranial enema and get all that 40 years of shit out of your head. You're like a little boy talking about pirates and dinosaurs like you knew them all personally, except you're too old to be a little boy, and that makes you hard to look at. I don't know what you've been doing since the 1960s, but had nothing to do with getting your ass woke up. Must have been some totally unrelated enterprise. I've heard a lot of foolishness in my time, and a lot of it sounded like that slop you were just spewing. But listen, I tell you this as a kindness. What you're talking about is nothing. 40 years of nothing. It means nothing. It goes nowhere. You are being lied to. You are the one doing the lying. And you are the lie.
I'm definitely in the right place.
Stanley begins to reply, but she holds up her hand to silence him and addresses the woman at his side.
Why'd you bring him here, Molly? He piss you off or something?
Molly, an attractive woman in her 50s, doesn't reply. Brett walks toward her and looks at her hard.
Oh, I know, says Brett with a laugh. I get it. You two started dating, right? Figured you were both spiritual folk, so it was a good fit. But then you couldn't hold your own against his big-ass brain and his career discipleship and his lineup of beloved gurus. So you brought him here to let me deal with him. Ain't that right, you little chicken shit?
She says it in a kind of affectionate way, so neither Molly nor anyone else takes offense. In fact, except for a certain glass-eyed rigidity that overtook whoever she addressed, no one ever seemed too offended by Brett's abrasive manner. I was really starting to like her. Straight talk in plain English. I had never seen anyone like her before, and I found her comforting. It's like thinking you're the only one of something, and then there's another one. And it makes the world a different place, slightly less alien. Not like you're connected, but like maybe you could be. Brett steps back a few paces to address the whole group. Whenever you have any sort of question like that, any sort of nonsense like that floating around in your head, your only goal should be to climb up out of the place where such a question seems to make sense. It's a short climb, I promise. Just one little step up. All that smelly talk about experience, consciousness, mankind, happiness, and guru is just pure stinking denial. And it don't belong here. If that's your thing, you're in the wrong place. We ain't here to indulge in that kind of playtime fantasy. Y'all pay good attention, because what you heard is exactly the kind of fertilizer they're selling you out there. This gentleman, Stanley, is like the poster child for spiritual myopia. Picture him sitting in the lotus position, forming upturned okay signs with his hands, eyes closed, smiling like a little bliss bunny. And behind him, this big-ass dump truck is burying him under a massive load of steamy manure. Y'all with me so far? And driving the truck, leaning out the window, giving the camera a big okay sign and smiling the way they do, is the beloved guru. How's that for a New Age poster? I'm keeping an eye on Stanley in case he's gonna need tackling. He's tight-lipped, but composed. I let Stanley ramble on a bit tonight because he's a prime example of someone who has managed, despite a good heart and a powerful mind, to keep himself totally in the dark through 40 years of searching for the light. That's a hell of a thing he's managed to do, and it's an important thing for y'all to take a look at and try to understand, because Stanley here is not the exception. He's the rule. Anywhere else, they'd be looking at this guy like he was practically a guru himself. She turns to Stan. Written a book yet, Stanley? He's watching her with a half smile, as if indulging her.
I happen to be working on a book about my years with... Of course you are. God bless you. I wish I could keep you in a jar.
She turns back to the group. What we see here with Stanley is a complete and total evasion, a subterfuge, as they say.
There ain't no answer to the kind of question Stanley just tried to ask. The question don't even mean anything. It just sort of sounds like it does. That's the point. That's why it's a subterfuge. Y'all know what a subterfuge is? If anyone doesn't, they're not jumping up to announce it. Stanley, I don't know what the hell to tell you. If I could go back 40 years and find you, I know what to say. I'd start by giving you a sharp rap on the nose to get your attention. Then I'd tell you what I tell these folks once a month. Stop being a dumbass. There ain't no law telling you to be a dumbass. You're doing it voluntarily. And my advice would be to give it up, or 40 years from now you're going to have some crazy broad in your face telling you it's too late for you, that you had your chance and you blew it, which is what I'm telling you now. The Chinese have a saying, the best time to stop being a dumbass is 40 years ago, and the second best time is now. Maybe a piano will fall on your head tomorrow and knock all that horse shit out of your head, but I don't see you having that kind of good luck. He starts to speak, and she cuts him off. Don't bother mincing words with me, Stanley. You got your self-importance and your missionary ideals to make you feel like you're someone special doing something saintly. But both them things is a lie. You're just another scared kid hiding from your own damn life. I can smell it like you've been dipped in cheap perfume. You're scared to open your eyes. So you dreamed up a world where you get to be Jesus, saving all the lepers and poor folk, and them all just kissing your ass for being such a pal. Heaven'll be striking up the band when they see you coming. She turns back to the group. Don't take it hard. None of you. That's what everybody does, including all your fancy mentors and gurus, and the craziest thing about it is not seeing how damn crazy it is. Take five, everybody. Stan and Molly leave the building briskly. Brett comes and sits down next to me. I guess I'm staring. What? She asks. I think I'm in love, I reply. Shows you got good sense, she says. She offers a hand, and we shake. Where are you from? I ask. Texas? All over. Army brat. What about the accent? Total bullshit. It's just a character that comes over me so I can talk to folks and not mess them up any worse than I found them. I ain't loud, and I never cuss, she grins. I'm shy. Quite a show you put on. Just clearing the pipes. If you don't keep an eye on them, they'll start bringing in their new age buddies, and the whole thing turns into a candlelit hug fest. Everyone singing kumbaya and saving the world. They bring me their ugly babies like I'm supposed to go all gaga and smooch them up. Ugly babies? They're beliefs. All beliefs are like ugly babies, don't you think? Everyone thinks theirs is the most beautiful in the world, but they all look and smell the same to me. I reckon it's our job to tell them their babies are ugly and to go throw them in the river. You ever make any sense of Buddhism? No, ma'am. Me neither. Just a lot of cheap perfume, from what I can tell. I must be wrong, but I know I'm right. Very impressive teaching style. Thanks in part to you. Until I read your book, I was a lot less clear out there. I knew what I knew, but I couldn't find the words. The doc gave me your book, and that's where I learned how to talk about all this. You have better success with men or women? It's about even, I think. But women are more expressive. Men get to a point where they just go off by themselves and you don't see them for a year or two. How about you? I'm batting zero, she says. But there's a few I'm watching. Give you a good feeling when someone makes it? I consider it for a moment.
Not really. She laughs and shakes her head. Damnedest thing, ain't it? She says. That was my first experience of Brett.